On Being is brought to you by the John Templeton Foundation, harnessing the power of the sciences to explore the deepest and most perplexing questions facing humankind. Learn how their grantees are helping to address the coronavirus crisis at templeton.org.
We live in unusual times, and this is an unusual show, a kind of spiritual book club edition of On Being. When Things Fall Apart is a tiny volume by Pema Chodron. She's one of the greatest living teachers and writers in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. I'm not Buddhist, but I carry this book with me wherever I go. So do others on our team, including our executive producer Liliana Maria Percy Ruiz and our art director Aaron Colasacco. So we set out to look for who else might be turning to this writing right now and quickly landed on the extraordinary musician and artist Devendra Banhart. He's described his copy of When Things Fall Apart as a literary version of an In Case of Emergency break glass box. So, from the emergency recording cave in my basement and his home studio in East Los Angeles, we read favorite passages to each other and reflect on what it is to be alive and looking for meaning right now. So maybe I'll read a few of these parts from When Things Fall Apart. Things falling apart is a kind of testing and also a kind of healing. We think that the point is to pass the test or to overcome the problem, but the truth is that things don't really get solved. They come together and they fall apart. Then they come together again and fall apart again. It's just like that. The healing comes from letting there be room for all of this to happen. Room for grief, for relief, for misery, for joy.
Amen. That is just so now. It is just perfect. That passage is perfect.
Yeah.
Perfect.
I would just love to hear you read these two paragraphs.
Of course. The journey goes down, not up. It's as if the mountain pointed downward, pointed toward the center of the earth instead of reaching into the sky. Instead of transcending the suffering of all creatures, we move toward turbulence and doubt. We jump into it. We slide into it. We tiptoe into it. At our own pace, without speed or aggression, we move down and down and down. With us move millions of others, our companions, in awakening from fear. At the bottom, we discover water. Right down there in the thick of things, we discover the love that will not die.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. This is experimental, but I figure since you're a musician, you know about improvisation, right?
Oh, that's funny.
This is an interview version of improvisation, both technically and content-wise.
I love that, the idea of the improvisational conversation.
Good.
You know?
Yeah.
Every conversation is kind of improvisational. This is
cool.
Yeah,
but I mean, this is the form here is different, too. Let's say this is a new genre, because, well, first of all, you know, we're both speaking from isolation.
Yes.
And reading this book that we both read as life has fallen apart again and again, but in a very special, catastrophic way right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea is that we would just kind of talk to each other about what's going on right now, but through the wisdom in this, in Pema Chodron's When Things Fall Apart. And let's just see what happens. How this works. Thank you for sending the passages that you marked up from your book.
I hear that you have 5 copies of this book.
I have at least 3, and they're not. I have 2 here in my house, and I think I know the one that you sent that you took a picture of. I have at the office. Yeah, that was kind of interesting too, to look at what was marked up in the different copies, which was probably a story of what was going on at that moment in my life when I read it last.
I had the same feeling.
Did you?
I've got the 20th anniversary edition because when I first got this book, it was that this is that book that you give to friends. But my version, it's got all these bookmarks already in it.
Yeah. Do you remember when you first discovered this book or how you discovered it?
I don't.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that that's your answer, because this felt like a question I couldn't not ask. But when I even asked it to myself, I have no memory of like an origin story with this book coming into my life, because I feel like it's accompanied me, you know, ever since. And I think for me also, I'm somebody who resisted the knowledge that things fall apart for a long time. And then I think when you finally accept that that is actually in the nature of reality again and again, you see it. And I think like it's a book, I just always have it somewhere. It's, you know, sometimes buried under a bunch of other books on my coffee table, but I carry it with me when I travel, you know, just in case I need it.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, what kind of book is this? What do you tell somebody? What is this? Someone says, what is this book? And the only answer I can think of is applicable wisdom, utilitarian wisdom. Like, it really is that tool. Okay, do I have my phone? Do I have a copy of When Things Fall Apart?
That's right.
Because I'm gonna need it
yeah,
through the day. Because
yeah.
It's like that thing, like you said, accepting that things fall apart is something I've been resisting for my entire life, and it's something that's been happening every day.
That's right.
and so it's not like once I realized, oh, that one time I realized that things do fall apart and I need to accept that everything is ever changing. Like that one time, and then I never had to deal with that ever again. It doesn't work that way. And so it is something to have in your tool belt, kind of.
Yeah. Well, I really just want to kind of walk through the passages that you sent and talk about them. I did pull out my copy and thought maybe just as we start, I mean, this is the very beginning. It's about fear. Intimacy with fear is the first chapter, and what could be more... I don't even want to use the word relevant because it's too mild right now, right? We feel this fear in our bodies. Embarking on the spiritual journey is like getting into a very small boat and setting out on the ocean to search for unknown lands. With wholehearted practice comes inspiration, but sooner or later, we will also encounter fear. For all we know, when we get to the horizon, we are going to drop off the edge of the world. Like all explorers, we are drawn to discover what's waiting out there without knowing yet if we have the courage to face it. This is like on the next page. I'm just going to read a few passages. That impermanence becomes vivid in the present moment. So do compassion and wonder and courage. And so does fear. In fact, anyone who stands on the edge of the unknown, fully in the present without reference point, experiences groundlessness. That's when our understanding goes deeper, when we find that the present moment is a pretty vulnerable place and that this can be completely unnerving and completely tender at the same time. Also, I think this experience of the unknown right now, but that notion of the unnerving and the tender coexisting, I've always thought is so beautiful.
It's like the opposite of the world we live in, meaning this is truth, this is reality, this is how we actually always feel, this is what's kind of always going on, and you don't hear about it in your day-to-day in the world. It's not like in the news next to what's happening. But it's there, it's bubbling under the surface, that uncertainty and that fear and that thirst too, to kind of go on something like a journey of self-discovery, let's say. But it's so nice because you don't feel so alone. That's kind of how I feel reading the book too. I go, oh gosh, I'm not alone.
Yeah.
And thanks for reading that. And I guess I kind of want to hear that 400 more times.
Yeah. And then reading it right now is this extreme, it's an extreme kind of technicolor version of things falling apart for everybody all at once. But it's also, at the same time, a magnification of something that's happening all the time, right? We recognize this.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I think that's why it can really kind of strike a chord with anybody, and you can just categorize it as wisdom. Because wisdom is so, I mean, it's really not owned by anyone or any particular philosophy or system.
Yeah.
Or like kind of religion, right? But you don't have to be a Buddhist to kind of get into it and to feel it. That's why it just kind of can go under wisdom. I mean, it has this lightness to it, I suppose, even though it's coming from an explicitly Buddhist place, but it's so, it feels very universal, you know? I mean, it's just like completely what's happening right now. And what's happening right now is also what's kind of happening in us all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know? It's like it's this tradition being this lens through which a person who is living fully in their body, fully in the world, going through life, then is able to articulate bedrock reality. Mm.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Well, do you want to read, you mark some passages in chapter 7, hopelessness and death.
Hopelessness and death. Ah. A real, you know, yeah.
Upbeat.
You know, start on something light. Let's start light and easy. So, yeah, okay, let's see. Page 37, chapter 7, hopelessness and death. If we're willing to give up hope that insecurity and pain can be exterminated, then we can have the courage to relax with the groundlessness of our situation. This is the first step on the path. In Tibetan, there's an interesting word, yetang che. The ye part means totally, completely, and the rest of it means exhausted. Altogether, yetang che means totally tired out. We might say, totally fed up. It describes an experience of complete hopelessness, of completely giving up hope. This is an important point. This is the beginning of the beginning. Without giving up hope, that there's something better to be, that there's someone better to be. We will never relax with where we are or who we are.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, right, who would have think? Hopelessness, that's the place to start. But it makes so much sense.
It does. It's funny because I don't know, the hopelessness piece, of course, I've read it 100 times, but when you had marked this passage, and that language had slipped my mind, and it almost actually felt a little bit dangerous, you know, right now.
I get that for sure.
That Tibetan word, totally, completely exhausted. I mean, just what an image. And I also, when I read that, I think of, you know, it's hard to be alive right now and have a modicum of security and not be overwhelmed in thinking about so many people who, you know, for whom the groundlessness is literal.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah. I mean, 100%. I think I look forward to, I guess here on the West Coast, it's 8 p.m. when, we all start cheering and clapping for first responders and people that are working in the medical community, healthcare workers. So at 8 p.m., pots and pans start banging and people start hollering and clapping, and somebody plays the national anthem on their electric guitar, like super loud. And it's just, it's beautiful. It's a really wild thing. And I grew up in Venezuela, in Caracas, Venezuela. And the last time I heard this was when they were trying to oust the president, Carlos Andrés Pérez, by Chávez trying to oust the president, which is so weird. The people were on his, and it's the whole thing, but they were banging on the pots, yelling, son nadie, que salga Carlos Andrés. But people, it was like propaganda. People didn't know what they were cheering for. It was just like total manipulation to get people to just the madness of the crowd, right?
Yeah.
And then this is this homegrown expression of gratitude and love. And it's so much, the difference is just night and day.
Right.
And I haven't felt it since I was, I guess I must have been 11 years old last time I experienced that in Caracas. But what's amazing about this passage is that, you know, when I say, again, so much about this book is like, oh, this is feels really real. This feels really true. But I don't really read about this in the news or through my day, throughout my kind of regular life conditioning. And it's like you think at the end of hope, that's it. Oh, man, that's it. I've given up. And so it's over. But actually, that's when it really begins. And I think that is so... ironically, so inspiring and hopeful, but it's really got to give up hope.
It's true. I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. Today, I'm with the musician Devendra Banhart. We're talking through our favorite passages of When Things Fall Apart, a classic spiritual work by Pema Chodron. You know, I use the word hope a lot, and I always use it, and I always say, hope is muscular, right? Hope is a muscle. Hope is a choice. And hope is in, like, optimism, which is, like, wishful thinking. So it challenges me when Pema Chodron, you know, uses this language of hopelessness. So then I was looking farther in the chapter after you sent your passages, and do you remember this? It's on, I think it's on the next page. She says that there's the word in Tibetan for hope is rewa. The word for fear is dokpa. And there's a word that is used which combines hope and fear. And she says, hope and fear is a feeling with two sides. As long as there's one, there's always the other. Mm. In the world of hope and fear, we always have to change the channel, change the temperature, change the music, because something is getting uneasy, something is getting restless, something is beginning to hurt. We keep looking for alternatives. This is another place she says, you could even put abandoned hope on your refrigerator door instead of more conventional aspirations, like every day in every way I'm getting better and better.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
You know, I have a tattoo gun, and I think I just found my next tattoo. Abandon hope.
Abandon
I mean,
hope.
I've never wanted to get a face tattoo, but I'm going to consider it. Just, wow, first thing I want to see in the morning. It's great. It's so it's freeing because it's, you know, I love that.
Right,
love that.
But just explain why it's freeing, because every time I start explaining it to myself here, I feel like it doesn't make sense.
Well, I will explain it by reading another passage.
Okay.
From actually the previous page. So this is the passage, and this is why I think it explains why it's so freeing. To hear abandoned hope. To think that we can finally get it all together is unrealistic. To seek for some lasting security is futile. To undo our very ancient and very stuck habitual patterns of mind requires that we begin to turn around some of our most basic assumptions, believing in a solid, separate self. Continuing to seek pleasure and avoid pain, thinking that someone out there is to blame for our pain. One has to get totally fed up with these ways of thinking. One has to give up hope that this way of thinking will bring us satisfaction. Suffering begins to dissolve when we can question the belief or the hope that there's anywhere to hide.
Yeah, that does it.
Yeah, that does it. I really, though, think that there's something very cool about what you said, that hope is a muscle, though. I mean...
Yeah, well, I like to think that what this gets at a bit is the inadequacy of words, right? So that, like, that hope contains a meaning that is different from this hope,
exactly.
Hope fear, this fear hope.
We should clarify that we're not saying that hope is bad and that we're anti-hope. We're not anti-hope.
No,
but we are kind of, it's more the reality of facing this delusional hope that's based on escaping suffering or just making everything good or running from something that feels bad, as opposed to, you know, that line, suffering begins to dissolve when we can question the belief or the hope that there's anywhere to hide.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. We're stuck together. We're in this together.
Yeah.
There's nowhere to hide. There's a billion distractions, and so much of our entire, you know, life is spent in those distractions. And those are very, you know, kind of subjective things, whatever our distraction is. I mean, I've got a bazillion, quadrillion, but the hope that suffering will go away if I don't look at it, that's not that's the wrong kind of hope. That's the hope we're not so into.
Yeah, right. Well, she talks about that hope we get addicted to.
Oh, sure, right. Like someday and if only. Those words that are like the worst words in the world.
Right.
You know, I'm going to do the thing. Well, someday will always keep us from doing the thing. And then if only will always keep us from doing the thing. So that hope in those kinds of, in this imagined projected future, that's the wrong kind of hope too.
Yeah.
But hope as a muscle is so beautiful. Like, I'm going to work on that, on hope. On, so it's kind of like positive. How about this? It's kind of like, what are our real, actual superpowers?
Mm.
Okay, like human superpowers are like patience. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm going to work on this like superpower, because if I called patience, I'm going to work on this superpower called kindness. I'm going to work on a superpower called gratitude. Because if I've got those things, if I really am like, I'm going to work on that, I can kind of maneuver through this world with these like superpowers, you know?
Yeah, I love that. And so when I think of hope that way, and I think it's true of everything you just said, the other superpowers, they work with reality, right? I'm not interested in something that works with ideals, really, or again, like wishes, but gratitude that is like based in reality, and reality as it is and not as we wish it to be, patience and hope and love, those are hard, robust. You're right, they're superpowers.
It doesn't, exactly, like you said, though, it's not a wishing thing.
No.
It's like, I have hope that I can deal with this badness that is definitely here with patience, with kindness, and find something to be grateful for from it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I have no faith. I have zero, zilch, zero faith in today being a good day. Today will not be a good day.
That's right.
But I can try to do good today.
Yeah.
You know, today I'm going to do a good thing. I'm going to try to do good. But today is not going to be a good day.
Yeah. Yeah. If it is, it will surprise you and be a pleasant surprise. After a short break, more with Devendra Banhart. And by the way, there is a beautiful thing happening on our Instagram, Poetry Unbound and Friends, including former On Being guests reading and reflecting on poems that are accompanying them now, including Ocean Vuong, Jericho Brown, and Maria Popova. You can watch all of these short, nourishing videos at On Being on Instagram.
Support for On Being with Krista Tippett comes from the Fetzer Institute, helping build the spiritual foundation for a loving world. Fetzer envisions a world that embraces love as a guiding principle and animating force for our lives, a powerful love that helps us live in sacred relationship with ourselves, others, and the natural world. Learn more by visiting Fetzer.org.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. Today, with a kind of spiritual book club edition, I'm with Devendra Banhart, who is Venezuelan-American, a Buddhist practitioner, and a multiply talented musician and artist. We're talking about When Things Fall Apart, a small work of great beauty by the Tibetan Buddhist teacher Pema Chodron. It's a work, like all works of spiritual genius, that speaks from the nooks and crannies and depths of a particular tradition while conveying truths about humanity writ large. I have learned much from the psychological acuity of Buddhism, which comes up in this conversation with Devendra about living with things falling apart right now. For example, there's a practice called Tonglen, receiving the pain of the world on an in-breath and sending out what you wish for the world on an out-breath. Or there's the notion of maras, which translates to demons or obstacles to being meaningfully present to experiences and present to our own capacity to meet them. So you also mark some passages in another delightfully titled chapter, Non-Aggression and the Four Maras.
Hmm.
Pema Chodron, in some place, this is how she summarized the Four Maras. And, you know, as you said, of course, I've always known this, but I never put words around it, right? So one Mara is seeking pleasure. One is trying to be who we think we are. The third, how we use our emotions to keep ourselves dumb or asleep.
Oof.
Yeah. And the fourth was fear of death, by which she doesn't just mean the big death, which is one form of death, but all the many small deaths that happen in the course of days and weeks in a life.
Hmm.
Do you want to read some of what you circled there?
Okay. The teachings tell us that obstacles occur at the outer level and at the inner level. In this context, the outer level is the sense that something or somebody has harmed us, interfering with the harmony and peace we thought was ours. Some rascal has ruined it all. This particular sense of obstacle occurs in relationships and in many other situations. We feel disappointed, harmed, confused, and attacked in a variety of ways. People have felt this way from the beginning of time. As for the inner level of obstacle, perhaps nothing ever really attacks us except our own confusion. Perhaps there is no solid obstacle except our own need to protect ourselves from being touched. Maybe the only enemy is that we don't like the way reality is now and therefore wish it would go away fast.
Yeah.
Yeah. Talk about not liking the way reality is now.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. I mean, if this is like a huge sledgehammer of now.
Yes.
Global
yes.
Now.
Yes. And I also have to say these passages are the ones, they feel so true for me. I mean, it's that we, each and every one of us, has to work out like who we are and how we are in this moment with a particular intensity. And then and then I also feel like there are so many people who are literally where these obstacles are existential. I wondered if also, like, you your mother was Venezuelan, right? You weren't born in Venezuela, but you went back there. And that is also a place that has had a lot of dire, kind of apocalyptic realities in recent years. And I wonder how you read these things, like how you've read that with that context, which to me feels resonant with now kind of what every country, every community is experiencing on some level, the severity.
Well, I feel like that passage deals with the inner and the outer obstacle, mm-hmm. and the outer obstacle is just unavoidable. It's just unavoidable. Hmm. Like, and it just grows in magnification, and I think Venezuela is a good example of that magnification that everyone's feeling now. But before this pandemic, you know, there was, like, think of Australia. I mean, there were these massive fires.
Right.
Like, Australia was on fire. And that was, like, real concentrated outer obstacle. And Venezuela, people with mass starvation. And, like, the entire country is being held hostage, basically, by the military and a dictator. I mean, this is insane. And this is real concentrated suffering. And then, of course, you know, Tibet, mass torture in Tibet. Yeah. And so these are really concentrated obstacles. And it doesn't seem like those things ever go away. And for me, practicing Buddhism is kind of like preparing for a pandemic. Only in that it's like a daily, oh, bear witness to the suffering of this world. Bear witness to the suffering that your emotions are causing you. Sit with it. Learn to sit with it. And then there's the inner obstacles. And I think that's like the beauty of and the usefulness so much. I mean, there's so many reasons why this book is useful, but one of them is that you can turn to it to be kind of taught how to kind of deal with the things you can deal with. And those outer obstacles will never really stop coming. But the inner ones, right, you can learn how to kind of dance with those. And, you know, and I think that's so helpful. But yeah, I mean, it's a compounded suffering now thanks to this, of course.
And the practice of Tonglen, which Pema Chodron also writes about, especially in this chapter, The Love That Will Not Die, that is, I've read that that's also something you practice on a daily basis.
Yes, Tonglen, taking and sending. Tonglen is really helpful. I don't know if it helps anybody but me, though. It's pretty selfish, actually. But it's like, how can I deal with reading the news in a way? So I'm just, it's like a headline after headline of horror. And so how do I deal with it? And so you kind of treat reading the news each day like, okay, this is a way of dealing with so much horror in the news. I'm bearing witness to it. And then I will practice Tonglen. I'm going to breathe in all the suffering, the anger, the pain, the confusion. And I'm going to breathe out healing and peace and wisdom and love and strength. And that helps me, and it feels like I'm doing something as opposed to just taking in all of this horror and sorrow. And you can practice it throughout your day. I don't know if it's the same for you, but every 15 minutes, I'm shocked at it actually. That's why I found a really kind of quiet place in the house. But every 15 minutes, I hear a siren or a cop siren. You know, it's an ambulance siren or a cop siren.
Is there? So you're in L.A. County.
I'm in L.A.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm in East L.A. And I don't know, is it the ambulance going to pick up a body? Is it somebody that's sick and needs immediate, you know, critical emergency care? Or is it a crime? I'm not entirely sure, but it is consistent. It's every 15 minutes. And it began, you know, when this began. And so what do you do? I hear it and I'm okay, I can practice Tonglen. This is kind of a way of somehow being proactive amidst the helplessness of so much suffering and horror around you. Now this is the deep kindergarten version of it.
Yeah.
So that, and I'm the kindergarten. I mean, yeah. I'm really like, I'm fully lay practitioner 101.
Well, for doing the 101 Tonglen, the way you described it really corresponds to how I feel Pema Chodron describes it in this book. Do you want to read some from that chapter, The Love That Will Not Die?
Yeah, absolutely. Chapter 14, The Love That Will Not Die. The father of a two-year-old talks about turning on the television and unexpectedly seeing the bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma City. He watched as the firemen carried the limp and bloody bodies of toddlers from the ruins of the daycare center on the building's first floor. He says that in the past he was able to distance himself from other people's suffering. But since he's become a father, things have changed. He feels as if each of those children were his child. He feels the grief of all the parents as his own grief. This kinship with the suffering of others, this inability to continue to regard it from afar, is the discovery of our soft spot, the discovery of bodhicitta. Bodhicitta is a Sanskrit word that means noble or awakened heart. It is said to be present in all beings, just as butter is inherent in milk and oil is inherent in a sesame seed. This soft spot is inherent in you and me.
I love that. This kinship with the suffering of others.
I love that too. I love that. And also this is like, you know, maybe at first you go, what am I talking about? Bodhicitta.
Yeah.
And then all we know, all we hear, then later we see it's like it's a Sanskrit word and it just means noble or awakened heart. And it's something we all have. That's it. This is not some like exclusive thing. It's something we all have. Talk about hopeful. Talk about like something to be like, whoa, it turns out I have this thing already. This noble or awakened heart is there.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. Today, I'm with the musician Devendra Banhart. We're talking through our favorite passages of When Things Fall Apart, a classic spiritual work by Pema Chodron. I mean, this thing that she goes on to talk about in this chapter is that, so as you say, we all have this. We have this ability, this softness, this ability to know, be present to be in kinship with the suffering of others. And yet, as we all also reflexively understand, we, you know, it just feels like too much, as you said, like reading the newspaper. I'm going to try the Tonglen because I can't read it. I can't read it all anymore. But what she says, when we think that by protecting ourselves from suffering, which I think is what I'm doing when I'm just turning off the news, is she says, we think that by protecting ourselves from suffering, we are being kind to ourselves. The truth is, we only become more fearful, more hardened, and more alienated. We experience ourselves as being separate from the whole. This separateness becomes like a prison for us, a prison that restricts us to our personal hopes and fears and to caring only for the people nearest to us. Curiously enough, if we primarily try to shield ourselves from discomfort, we suffer. So when you're practicing Tonglen, like reading the newspaper or whatever, I mean, she talks about this as a practice that it can be ordinary. It can also be, in the summer, she says, brushing your hair, listening to the rain, making music, which you have some experience at. So it's just a frame of mind with which you approach something? Or is that how it starts?
Kind of. I mean, it's definitely also a way of kind of unburdening yourself from yourself, too, because it's a relief to care about somebody else. It's a really, it's a relief to get out of your head, too. Mm-hmm. So like I say, I don't know if it is helping that person that I'm sending that wave of love, of strength, of wisdom, of healing. I don't know if it's helping them, but it helps me. And that's the 101 kind of place to be, because I that classic story of when the airplane is, there's no oxygen, you know, you don't put the mask on the kid first, you put it on yourself, and then you can put it on on the child. And it's like, okay, you have to kind of work on yourself in order to be able to help others. And that Tonglen is a really, really wonderful way of having a kind of consistent practice of getting out of yourself and being compassionate for others and remembering that there are other human beings on this planet, because there's no shortage of the opportunity to work on it. And especially now there's no shortage. There's no shortage. That's why it is this sledgehammer of nowness. Like, whoa, this is like a constant thing that is happening, and it is not kind of just going away because we wanted to. We're really forced to lean into the sharp edges more than ever. We're standing on a sharp edge. We're sitting on it.
Right.
You know, and the really cool thing about Pema Chodron's wisdom style is kind of like, it's about kind of be curious. There's this kind of underlying, like, approach this fear and approach this anxiety and approach this heartbreak with a curiosity. Like, oh, this is interesting. Like, I'm just a tourist here, checking it out, taking photos. I don't actually live in this place. You know, and so this is
because,
like,
it is happening, whether you want it to or not, whether you like it or not. It is happening.
And can I approach it with this curiosity? Whoa, this is happening. Or, this is happening. You know, this is kind of this attitude. Can I just have a little bit more curious kind of feeling about it? And then I can let the wave kind of pass because, wow, I don't think I've ever personally felt, nor had my friends and family feel so completely distracted and focused at the same time, and so completely exhausted and weirdly energized at the same time, and so completely overwhelmed by uncertainty and fear than now, you know. And it's this tidal wave, and so yeah. I'll get a call or a text, and they're going through the tidal wave. What is going to happen? What's going to happen? And at that moment, maybe I'll be in this feeling of, hey, it's okay. I feel pretty calm. I can accept that. I never know what's going to happen, actually. So I can kind of talk them through the tidal wave. And then I'll need to call someone because I'm going through the tidal wave.
Right, right.
But through it all, if I can remember, like, Pema's cool wisdom style of curiosity, like, oh, okay. Whoa, I'm in a wave. This is interesting. Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
And also what I like about that is, and this I think is true of spiritual disciplines and spiritual practices that, and, you know, virtues, what do you say, those superpowers of, like, gratitude and patience and hope, that in any given moment, carrying any of those is too much to ask of somebody, maybe in any given year.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but we also carry them together, right? Like in that, you know, in the one phone call, you're able to be present to that. Mm-hmm. And then somebody can offer you that gift that, like, none of this spiritual wisdom or spiritual resilience follows the American rules of, you know, being self-made men, right?
It's
some of the ways we've just been trained culturally, you know, get in the way of grasping what this is about. It's not about being heroic. It's not about being heroic. It's not about being saints.
And, you know, that American thing definitely isn't just American. I'd say it's a global thing, this kind of global, you know. Children, I don't know in what country are children taught that, you know, they can find strength in vulnerability. It's okay not to know. It's okay to cry. You know, these things are just like, whoa, I don't know where they tell them that. You have to, like, yeah, that's why this book is so amazingly helpful, because it's so just fully applicable on a very universal, you know, platform.
I was thinking when you were speaking a minute ago about, there were a couple of passages I marked right at the beginning of the book in the When Things Fall Apart chapter that I thought I might read. Mm-hmm. And then I was actually going to ask you to read something. I just want to say, before I do this, I've been listening to a lot of your music, just like had it on in the background, like constantly in the last few days.
Things are tough enough, you know, you don't really need to add that burden
no,
on yourself.
No, it's been so wonderful. But you know your song, The Body Breaks, which is...
Yes.
I don't know, I feel like so much of the weird thing that we shouldn't have to wake up to, but that we do, is that we inhabit bodies and that they're frail and, right? It's just this truth in our midst, and that song. And it's also so beautiful, such a beautiful a thing that gives us such pleasure. And I don't know, I feel like that song evokes all of that right now in a way that it probably wouldn't have been if we weren't in the midst of a pandemic. It would have to have different, it would be landing differently in me.
Well, thank you for saying that. Thank you.
So maybe I'll read a few of these parts from When Things Fall Apart, just because I just want to read them and see if they They struck me when I was getting ready. Things falling apart is a kind of testing and also a kind of healing. We think that the point is to pass the test or to overcome the problem, but the truth is that things don't really get solved. They come together and they fall apart. Then they come together again and fall apart again. It's just like that. The healing comes from letting there be room for all of this to happen. Room for grief, for relief, for misery, for joy. A little bit later on, she says, the only time we ever know what's really going on is when the rug's been pulled out and we can't find anywhere to land. We use these situations either to wake ourselves up or to put ourselves to sleep. Right now, in the very instant of groundlessness, is the seed of taking care of those who need our care and of discovering our goodness.
Amen. That passage is perfect. Perfect.
Yeah.
And you know, there's also something really, really hopeful in that when you initially read, things kind of come together and they fall apart. There's that sorrow. Oh, no, I don't want it to fall apart.
Yeah.
Like, you know, yeah. I'm going to hold on to that good thing. But then look at it inversely, and it's like, this time will pass. This yeah. is going to fall yeah. apart too. This thing we're going through, this pandemic, it will fall apart.
Yeah, yeah, right. The falling apart will fall apart too.
So that's nice. So we can embrace, we can celebrate
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
Because it's a fact. Things fall yeah. apart.
Yeah. Okay, this is page one. Okay, this is, in my version, these are the last two paragraphs of the Love That Will Not Die chapter. Would you?
See.
I would just yeah. love to hear you read these two paragraphs.
Of course. Spiritual awakening is frequently described as a journey to the top of a mountain. We leave our attachments and our worldliness behind and slowly make our way to the top. At the peak, we have transcended all pain. The only problem with this metaphor is that we leave all the others behind. Our drunken brother, our schizophrenic sister, our tormented animals and friends. Their suffering continues, unrelieved by our personal escape. In the process of discovering bodhicitta, the journey goes down, not up. It's as if the mountain pointed downward, pointed toward the center of the earth instead of reaching into the sky. Instead of transcending the suffering of all creatures, we move toward turbulence and doubt. We jump into it. We slide into it. We tiptoe into it. We move toward it however we can. We explore the reality and unpredictability of insecurity and pain, and we try not to push it away. If it takes years, if it takes lifetimes, we let it be as it is, at our own pace, without speed or aggression. We move down and down and down. With us move millions of others, our companions in awakening from fear. At the bottom, we discover water, the healing water of bodhicitta. Right down there in the thick of things, we discover the love that will not die.
The body breaks and the body is fine. I'm open to yours and I'm open to mine. The body aches and that ache takes its time, but you'll get over yours and I'll get over mine. And the sun will shine and the moon will rise.
Devendra Banhart is a singer-songwriter and visual artist. He's released 10 albums, including Rejoicing in the Hands and, most recently, Ma. Special thanks this week to Nico Odysseus and Caitlin Ross of Shambhala Publications for their generosity in granting us permission to excerpt from Pema Chodron's When Things Fall Apart.
las alas el mundo te espera, una sorpresa que Dios te guarda.
The On Being Project is
Chris Heagle,
Lily Percy,
Lauren Dordal,
Aaron Colasacco, Kristen Lin,
Eddie Gonzalez,
Lillian Vo,
Lucas Johnson,
Suzette Burley,
Zach Rose,
Siri Grassley,
Colleen Check,
Christiane Wartell,
Julie Seipel,
and Gretchen Honnold.
The On Being Project is located on Dakota land. Our lovely theme music is provided and composed by Zoe Keating. And the last voice that you hear singing at the end of our show is Cameron Kinghorn. On Being is an independent production of The On Being Project. It's distributed to public radio stations by PRX. I created this show at American Public Media. Our funding partners include the Fetzer Institute, helping to build the spiritual foundation for a loving world. Find them at Fetzer.org. Calliopeia Foundation, dedicated to reconnecting ecology, culture, and spirituality, supporting organizations and initiatives that uphold a sacred relationship with life on Earth. Learn more at Calliopeia.org. Humanity United, advancing human dignity at home and around the world. Find out more at humanityunited.org, part of the Omidyar Group. The Osprey Foundation, a catalyst for empowered, healthy, and fulfilled lives. And the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interests in religion, community development, and education.
On Being is produced by On Being Studios in Minneapolis, Minnesota.